You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
This is the CRM Archaeology Podcast. It's the show where we pull back the veil of cultural resources management archaeology and discuss the issues that everyone is concerned about. Welcome to the podcast. Hello and welcome to the CRM Archaeology Podcast, episode 141. I'm your host, Chris Webster. On today's show, we talk about the challenges of creating a universal site form for archaeology. So break out your databases and digital site forms because the CRM Archaeology Podcast starts right now. All right, welcome to the show, everybody. Joining me today is Stephen in Calgary.
Hello.
And Doug in Scotland.
Hey.
I've talked a lot about our topic today on the Archaeotech podcast. Actually, we've never really talked about creating a universal site form as a single topic on the Archaeotech podcast, which is kind of a weird thing. But I don't think it belongs there either. It's not really a technology issue. It's more of a theoretical issue. You know, should we or should we not do this sort of thing? But I wanted to talk about it with you guys on this podcast because we're used to working in different places, you know, around the country, and we see different things. We see different site forms. We see different ways of recording. And it, even before I started getting into, quote, digital archaeology, which is a term I don't like at all, but I'm going to use it for this purpose. But even when I started getting into digital archaeology, I started thinking, man, you know, a lot of the states I've worked in, I've worked in about 17 or 18 different states. A lot of the states I've worked in, sure, they all have their own different forms, but I'm kind of recording the same information in all of these states. Like the terms are different. The drop-down menus are different. The, you know, the terminology is a little bit different for what they call something. But in reality, I'm recording sites, artifacts, and features, and I'm describing them. I mean, the rest is details. And sometimes it's those details that can cause a problem. But that's what got me first thinking about the usability of a universal site form. So I've got some ideas and some ways I want to talk about this, but I want your guys' first impressions of this. When I say universal site form, what does that mean to you? And it's interesting, first off, the fact that you guys are both international now too. So I know you've both obviously worked in the United States, but Doug is in Scotland and Stephen is in Canada. So this might have a different implication, but I still think that you could make a universal site form for much of the world, really, with some minor variations, and especially if it's digital and those variations can be done on the fly. But what are you guys' first impressions when I say universal site form? Doug, you unmuted first, so you win the prize. Go ahead.
Can I take us down a rabbit hole real quick?
Absolutely.
Yeah, Chris, wait, why don't you like the term digital archaeology?
Well, because on the last Archaeotech podcast, which I think releases next week, so it's not actually live yet, we discussed the May issue of Advances in Archaeological Practice from the SAA, and it's a whole special issue about the reuse of archived data, you know, data people are done with basically after the project, and people reusing that, having access to that and things like that. And they use the term digital archaeology pretty extensively. And one of the things I mentioned in that podcast was, I don't like the term digital archaeology because it tends to separate it from archaeology, right? And all of us are digital archaeologists, whether we know it or not. We're storing data digitally. We're collecting data digitally, even if it's just GPS data. And saying digital archaeology puts that box around it that tends to scare certain people when they hear the word digital. And they're like, oh, I don't understand it. I don't want to go down that hole. But you're a digital archaeologist, whether you like it or not. And in fact, you're just an archaeologist. And we talk about, quote, digital archaeology and understanding how to create a database and use a database in the field and add things to it and make it usable. We talked about that being a universal skill in a relatively short period of time, just like being able to, you know, use a shovel or use a trowel. You know, those are things we consider universal skills. I'm sure some people are better at it than others, but same with creating databases for a project. That should be a universal skill in not too long of a period of time, because if you don't do that properly, then, you know, what's the point in collecting data if you don't collect it in a way that's usable? That's why I don't like the term digital archaeology. Stephen, you got a comment on that?
Yeah, and just to further keep us from talking about our actual topic today, I've noticed that because, like, the rise of the digital methods and stuff like that, it's really forced a lot of us to think about archaeology in like data management, data science terms. Like, we've started to think about types and categories and how we're working with these things on a more like average level, you know, whereas before it was a lot more, you could have things in the same class that weren't really comparable because you could get away with it when it wasn't like physically structured within databases.
Right.
But with the, you know, increase of database use, and particularly GIS use, you know, in the 90s and then into the aughts, things became harder and harder to categorize, you know, to lump in together. Unless you were very careful about how you were defining things. Mm-hmm. And so that, I don't know really where I'm going with this, but what you were saying about how we're all kind of digital archaeologists.
Yeah.
I think that has an effect on how, like, your day-to-day field archaeology, like, even if you're just out there digging shovel tests and counting rocks and whatever, that applies. That structure is how you're doing your job.
Yeah. And Stephen, you might be able to describe what I'm actually saying as far as digital, quote, digital archaeology and data creation in the field, like born digital data. You might be able to explain that in terms of GPS, because I know you were around and doing archaeology when, you know, GPS started becoming a thing. And there were probably a bunch of old guard people that were like, I'll never use a GPS and, you know, and I'll never figure it. I'll never do this. And they did. They took a long time to figure it out. But now it's like, if you don't know how to operate a handheld GPS, maybe not a Trimble, that's still kind of a skill people acquire. But like your basic handheld GPS, if you don't know how to find a point and follow a transect through the GPS, I mean, you may as well just leave and go home at this point. When did that happen? Well, you know?
I think it's still happening, honestly.
Well, sure. When people come in the field, but they have to learn it right away.
No. I think when it happens, like here in Alberta, we have to supply digital data.
Right.
There are specific types of data that they want as part of the submission. It's not just reports. It's not just maps. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, they want to see ground survey area. They want to see where all the subsurface inspections are. That includes shovel tests, backhoe tests, you know, whatever, surface finds. And when that became a requirement, all of a sudden, I think for a lot of people my age or older, and for those of you who don't know, I'm in my mid 40s. Mm-hmm. Like everything changed.
Yeah.
Like the way that you're recording data now is different. The way that, like, even the, what's the numerical authority when you know, for reporting number of tests and depths and all that, when you get back to the office, mm-hmm. that's changed. You know, whereas it used to be, you know, what you remembered and then what's in your notes that helps you remember it or whatever. All of a sudden now it's a lot more driven by GPS units, mm-hmm. right? Or whatever digital tablets you're using or digital forms or,
right.
or what have you. I think, though, that if it weren't a requirement, there would still be plenty of people who just never changed their methods. Mm-hmm. That, yeah, they've got a GPS, but they don't really think about, like, okay, I need to have, you know, I need to categorize waypoints differently so that when we get back, we can easily, like, separate them out as what they are.
Right.
You know, they're taking waypoints in the way that, you know, a lot of people take field notes, where it's like it's something there to help me remember where something is.
Yeah.
And particularly with garments, because they're so they're trash at what we make them do. Yeah, right. Yeah. like you can't do a polygon. You know you can kind of, like, well, I'm just gonna walk in a circle and find that loop in my tracks later and and then trace over it, right? Like, mm-hmm. and you get one type of waypoint, that's all you get. And then, you know, the way we work is that we structure, you know, either the name of the point or have some sort of coding in the comments that can easily get parsed out through, like, a regex, that regular expression.
Mm-hmm.
If you weren't required to parse all this stuff out, as part of the spatial data. You would a lot of people would never do this.
Yeah.
Particularly people who started out in the pre-GIS days, in the pre-GPS days.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that depending on where you are and what the requirements are, it very much would depend on, those things, who you are, and like, when did you start doing it and what were the tools that you learned with?
Yeah.
And you might like really appreciate the efficiencies and stuff, but you're not necessarily trained to think of that data, mm-hmm. that data recording as a method rather than as, something as a crutch.
Right. Well, that goes along with our whole universal site record discussion today. But before we go into that, Doug, how'd you feel about my digital archaeology explanation?
No, it was good. It was good. And actually, I can probably bring it back to our main conversation, actually, because your original question was, how is a universal site form, how would that work in some place like the UK? And in the UK, there might be another form of recording, but essentially it's all single context recording.
Mm-hmm.
And every company has a slightly different form on how you do it. They might have the context number field laid out slightly different and stuff like that. But again, if we're talking about all archaeologists, digital archaeologists, at some point it all needs to go into a database or, be a structured data. That's the forms. Actually, now that I think of it, pretty much maybe one form might have an extra bit for comments. And something like that. But basically if it goes digital, it's all going into a similarly put together database. And essentially a universal form, the only difference is you're going to be looking at like tweaking things on the in the margins. And I literally mean like the literal margins. Like a lot of the forms, the difference is, they've slightly positioned something here. The font might be a little bit bigger.
Mm-hmm.
The box is a little bigger for you to write stuff, so you have a little more room for comments here. But as we move more digital for digital recording, I wouldn't be surprised if in the future there's only two or three sort of digital forms or versions of the forms, and they probably end up with almost the exact same database.
Right.
I could see some people getting a little fancy with the metadata with stuff like, recorded by this person at this exact time. I mean, you're supposed to put who recorded it anyways and the date, but with digital stuff, you might be able to do timestamps and.
Well, that's actually easy to do and almost a requirement because most of the digital recording systems I've seen require you to log in. So there's your name. And also every single piece of data you put in a field is date and timestamped automatically because it is a database and that's just how that works. So it's kind of a handy thing. So you never have to go back and say, who wrote this? Because you know exactly who wrote that. Unless somebody else logged into someone else's tablet with their, the wrong login.
And the thing I could see is where we might start running into, say, innovation sort of runaway competition is at the moment, there's only so much you can do with a paper form.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of projects are now doing photogrammetry for the trenches. So that's almost replacing sketch drawings and stuff like that, which I have different feelings about. I think a drawing is a one way to represent it. And sometimes it can really, if you did the drawing correctly, you're bringing out details that you wouldn't be able to see in a photograph. But
mm-hmm.
I mean, if you're looking at forms and you're looking at basically a competition of how much new data you can add into your form. So if you have your basic stuff, such as, what's the context number, what's its relation to the other context above and below it, or next to it, what's the descriptions and stuff like that. That's all very basic text fields, as it were.
Yeah.
But if you start doing stuff like, take a photographic, a photograph here, or do photogrammetry of what you're looking at. that starts adding a whole new bit to a form that isn't standard.
Yeah.
And that I think is really valuable data, but I can see it start to cause forms to differ. I don't know. I guess if you had a universal, my worry, if you had one universal form or form, one universal form, you might stifle innovation, and that you'd have to have an organization who's in charge of it or some sort of consortium who is actually constantly thinking about, hey, how do we make this better? If not, basically you're just going to have a universal form that doesn't change and may not adapt to how archaeology is changing. I'd say we're probably changing faster now than we ever have in the last, 100, 200 years.
I totally agree. It's that would have to be a hallmark of any digital form. Let me talk about that for a second. So that would have to be a hallmark is revisions and changes. And I think that is because these are going to be created and maintained by probably private firms early on and then possibly agencies later on. But that would require them to have an IT team that's staying up on, app development and things like that. So I don't see that happening anytime soon, but it's definitely run by somebody. And this company is going to be concerned with making sure they're accurate and correct. And there will have to be a consortium, like you said, or a way to submit requests, change requests. And there's a lot of apps have like a voting system where you can you put in a request for a change. Let's say you do it on the website. You put in a request for, hey, I would like this feature. You look to see if that's already listed. And if it is, you just vote for it. You sign in, put your name down there and vote for it. And when the feature hits X number of votes, it gets added to the thing, right? I've seen that before because app developers, they can't stay on top of every minute request because it might just be something that benefits one person. But if it benefits 1,000 people, then they'll do it. But that's the thing that I want to make you guys very aware of here. I'm not necessarily even just talking about digital site recording, like site recording on tablets and things like that. I'm literally talking about a universal site form. This could be on paper if you wanted it to be, and then move to digital. So if people still want to use paper, that's fine. What I'm really asking you here, and I think we're going to take a break and get your answers on the other side of that, but what I'm really asking you here is just the concept itself of a universal site form, whether it's on paper or tablet or not. And maybe what we'll find out by the end of this discussion is that it has to be on a tablet because of the minute changes that has to happen to the form. But maybe not. That's not where my premise is. My premise is just a list of fields that you can record anything anywhere in the entire United States, if not other countries, if not the entire world, right? Is there a set of attributes that you could put on a piece of paper or in some sort of format that would encompass, 80% of the sites out there? You always use the 80-20 rule when you're developing. You develop for the 80% and the 20%, well, they'll get most of what they need, but that's the thing there. So let's take a break because we are at our time for this segment, and we will be back in just a minute or two to continue this discussion. Back in a second. Hey, podcast fans and digital archaeologists. Have you heard about WildNote? It's a data collection app that works online or offline on your smartphone or tablet, iOS or Android. It allows you to collect field data easily, manage data efficiently, and generate data reports and site records effortlessly. We have a growing list of state site forms built in for your use and some generic forms that will work anywhere. Check out the shovel testing and photograph forms. You can get a free all-access 30-day trial today by going to wildnoteapp.com. That's wildnoteapp.com for your free 30-day trial. Tired of the webinars and training offered by the big organizations not being free for members and not really covering what we need? Team Black has the answers. Check out arccert.black/main for our upcoming webinar schedule. All of our webinars happen once a month and seating is limited. Learn everything from field tech basics to drones to digital workflows. We have more classes coming online every month. Classes are always 1 hour. Classes like building a CV and getting a job are always free. That's right. We'll help you get a job, then we'll be here when you want to level up your skills. If you are a professional subscriber to the APN at arcpodnet.com/members, then you get all of Team Black's offerings for free as part of your membership. We have Team Black memberships coming that will give the same for the APN. So $20 a month gets you all the APN swag and extras, plus free training from Team Black. So check out arccert.black for more information and level up your skill set today. That's arccert.black. Now back to the show. All right, welcome back to the CRM Archaeology Podcast, episode 141. And we're talking about the advantages and disadvantages to creating a universal site form. At least we started getting into it at the end of the last segment. And Stephen, you've got a comment on something I mentioned.
Yeah, the way you were describing the process of, you know, making this thing or running it or updating it, you know, mm-hmm. for what Doug was talking about, it sounded very much like this would be coming from, like, you know, what the archaeologist, the field archaeologists want. And that's not where site forms are coming from. Like site forms come from, you know, what the jurisdictional agency wants, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, most site forms come from like state archaeologist or provincial archaeology, or, you know, maybe if you're on federal land or something like that, like, you know, like a certain, like maybe the BLM has its own specific use this form type thing. So, you know, I think that's kind of taking it the wrong way. It's like, you know, looking for innovation from the field guys is not where you're going to see a lot of changes. A lot of changes are going to be coming from the top down. You know, also that, you know, the hardest issue with a universal site form would be, how do you get all of these agencies to agree, right? Like,
yeah.
We did a show on site forms and databases with Jolene and Kelsey, but we'll have that in the show notes. And you know, we talked about that, you know, basically we're recording, like you were saying at the beginning of this episode, we're recording all the same stuff, same type of stuff, you know, number of artifacts, number of features, number, you know, environmental description, and site types and classifications and stuff like that. But most of our categories are slightly different, so they don't actually mesh up. Like, so mm-hmm. while it's the same type of data, they're not actually directly relatable categories.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, as far as like just the potential of coming up with a universal site form, that would make it, you know, like really hard, because how are you going to get everybody to agree that, like, oh, okay, we're going to change our definition, the definition that we've used for the past 50 years for, you know, campsite.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, and it's like, why should they? What's in it for them when, you know, when it's going to make relating to previous recording that much tougher?
Sure, sure. But I think it's actually simpler than that, because while I said at the end of the last segment that I don't necessarily mean, you know, we're talking about creating a universal digital site form, it could be anything you want. The advantage of doing it digitally, and this is something I was actively working on with a previous company, and now I'm working on with a current company. It's basically creating a universal front end, you know, a universal UI on the front end that if you're working in Calgary or you're working in Wisconsin or you're working in Nevada, you're going to see basically the same front end when you record stuff. You're going to see features and artifacts and, you know, various things. But when you export, you choose the agency that you need to export as, and the export modifies its fields, basically its field names and all that stuff, to fit the form that you're exporting for the agency. Because the one thing I've noted looking at site forms across the entire country is, and I've looked at all the site forms for all 50 states, and some of them don't even have site forms really, but I've looked at all of them, and they're all basically the same thing. The fields are in different spots. Sometimes they ask for different information, but it's really kind of the same information. Like, for example, you look at California, they've got an extra like three or four forms that are for milling stations and linear features and rock art and things like that. But those are all still just features. right? I mean, they're all still just features. They just called them out with extra information. They said, okay, these are features, but we want to know these things specifically about these features. But in the end, they're still just features. It's an entire form for a feature. So you can create these things and then just have the export fit the agency. And so the agency won't actually have to, you know, the agency will have to stay abreast of the agency changes and things like that. But that's how I think it's going to initially be done digitally and accepted digitally, is the agencies aren't even going to know people are collecting data that way unless they ask for the digital information. Then they might see it, but they're really just going to see a PDF of the site form that was generated from the, you know, from the input. But going back to what you were saying earlier too, about how these changes come about from the agencies and they're not basically crowdsourced by archaeologists, you're right. That's the way it's done now. But these forms were created by archaeologists back in, you know, back in the day when people were just recording stuff and there were no real agencies that were in charge of the whole process. You know, there was universities and other things, and they created these forms to make everything better. So people coming in the field, they had prompts basically, and they said, okay, I need you to look at this, this, and this. So they created these forms. And when the agencies started gaining more authority, they started adopting either those forms or adopting several forms and creating something that said, okay, we've got a mess of stuff coming in. We've taken all you guys, these forms you're turning in, and we've created this one thing. Use that. And then like in the BLM Nevada, it didn't change for 30 years. And then they finally just made a major change just a few years ago to the site form here. But the point is, the agencies are doing it now because they can't rely on all the individual companies to do it themselves, right? Because they would get a mess of data coming in that they don't know what to do with. So they are doing it. But if there was a way that everything could be, you know, sort of crowdsourced as far as the front end UI goes, but the back end ships them the data in the format that they require with the fields they require, then I don't think they care what the front end looks like. You could have 80 different types of features that you're going to record, but it's still going to come in to one field that says feature. And that feature is going to have several subfields that says type, location, description, associated artifacts, whatever the case may be. But in the end, it's still just a feature. And that's all the agency cares about. You know, when you get all said and done. So that's, I don't know, that's my research anyway, and the people I've talked to and how this has all come about.
Yeah. So how do you deal with competing types, classes?
Well, you don't have to. You don't have to really, because on the forms these days, you look at site forms and sure, some of them have checkbox that say, I've got a prehistoric feature. It's one of these eight things, right? You know, for this area, it's one of these things or it's other, right? And those things have a definition in some sort of guide out there. But in reality, there's, you know, you talk to the people at like Open Context, because that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to set a specific set of terms that works for all this stuff. So we don't have 75 terms for pottery coming in. You can use your own term, but it all classes down to this one thing. And I don't think it's as big a problem as you're thinking it might be, because, you know, the people I've talked to in a bunch of different states regarding these things, the definitions for these things that we have, like these site types and stuff like that, they're not that different. They're not that different. And in the end, it doesn't really matter, because you're still describing it. You're still, if it might just mean we don't have a dropdown for site type. Like you just write it in or something like that. Or maybe we have a drop down that's specific to, I don't know, whatever, a region or something, but then you're clouding the issue. But it's not as different as you think. And really it comes down to teaching people how to describe things better. You know, you teach people how to describe, then it doesn't matter what you call it, because calling it something puts it in a box anyway, and you could be wrong. So just describe what you're seeing and maybe call it nothing. That would be my preference. Don't call it a campsite if you don't know it's a campsite, you know? But seeing campsite in a checkbox is putting a bias on that that says this is a campsite, and you could be wrong because that's the only thing that fit. You know, that's why you checked it.
I'm going to be super controversial here and say we Absolutely. Probably shouldn't actually have site forms.
Yeah, I think we should just have data myself.
Yeah, well, in a sense, so we really don't. So here in the UK, there's single context recording, but that's recording within a site, which mm-hmm. is basically similar to how you're describing how some states have forms for every type of feature. And basically you're recording features in context. And there's other forms for the different national agencies for when you're, say, submitting a monument. And then there'll be a form for when you're potentially submitting something into the local authority. They'll be saying something along the lines of, an excavation took place here, and you know, this is a known campsite or whatever, and stuff like that. And there's all sorts of problems with the data going across, but I am of the view that sites tend to be arbitrary.
Mm-hmm.
And I know for legal reasons, we have to, you have to be able to draw a circle on a map and say, hey, that's, you know, that's a place where there's a site. You either have to do an excavation, you know, mitigation of some sort in that area. And then, you know, at least in the Western United States, that just means they avoid that area and, you know, put the oil well 20 meters to the left or to the right, mm-hmm. or, you know, whatever it is that needs to happen. But you could still do that with sort of density stuff, you know, density maps and sightless surveys. But the problem with sites is anytime you re-record them, the shape changes because you see new artifacts. And unless you do a full 100% excavation and removal of everything, you won't know the full extent of the site. And that is still assuming that you actually catch most of it and aren't missing other stuff. And then when do you separate out the distance? You know, obviously some places have rules, but all the rules tend to be slightly different in, oh, you know, it has to be 20 feet away or 100 meters or whatever it is before it has to be considered a new site. You know, however far away that flake has to be or that pile before it gets labeled as a new site. I think that would probably run into some issues with the universal site form, in that definitions of sites are so varied. And I don't know, I'd say it's the least interesting part about a form, anything like that. And if you're doing recording, I'd say actually a universal site form, and you guys can't see it, but I'm doing air quotes, should actually be similar to like a feature or a context, a single form for recording archaeological resources that has the data and that doesn't label stuff too much. Mm-hmm. So if you basically, you've put enough data in there, and however people want to label that later, they can do it. And it could fit into, I don't know, whatever their category or however they've decided their hierarchy of sites needs to work, or,
yeah,
you know, whatever it is. But I'm actually kind of opposed to the idea of site forms, but that's just me.
No, you're actually talking, you know, a level above what I wanted to talk about, because you're totally right. We're moving to a world where there will be no more site forms. I mean, that's just a simple fact. The more data we record, the more just simple raw field data, where we're describing things, we're taking points on everything. You know, when that becomes way easier to do, right now we don't take points on like every single, you know, piece of debitage out there or flake. You know, we record it, but we take points on diagnostics. But that's really because it's a time issue. You know, we haven't had the time or ability to really sit and record everything. So the agency says, okay, well, just do diagnostics, you know, something like that. But in reality, if we recorded literally everything out there, we didn't put a boundary around it, we just described what we saw. And then if somebody else needed to come in there, like a developer or whoever, and put a road through there, well, then somebody adds a computer algorithm for the current definition of a site in that region based on current research and says, okay, a site is defined as this many artifacts in this many classes or this many features or a combination of all three of those and a 10 meter buffer or something like that. And it just draws a bunch of circles and you say, okay, put your road through here, or we have to go excavate, or we have to go monitor, or we have to go do something. But the more we record just raw data, you're totally right, the less a site form is going to be needed. But I think that's beyond and in the future from, you know, I think that's in our future, but I think something along the lines of a universal site form, or at least digital site recording, in a little more friendly UI sort of way, is going to be the first step to that. But you're right. Once we're doing that, people are going to realize, why are we even putting this in a form in the end of the day? Why aren't we just saving it as data? Stephen?
Well, you kind of started to answer what I was going to say, but I think part of the point of having a site form is not just so developers know where to avoid, but it's also it's a quick summary, right? Like if I'm going to go back out and look in the, and do some work in a particular area, and there's this site right next door, or this work that's been right next door, it is a quick summary of easily presentable data, and so it's not just about, you know, where is there stuff, where is there not stuff, but it actually is like a reference.
Sure, we do that now though with GIS systems. Like if you go click on a point, if you got a good database backing that GIS, you click on that point, you see everything you need to know about that point. I mean, there's no reason we can't do that now with site data. You know, if all I need is a quick site description or a summary of the site, I can click on that point and I can get all the information that I need to know about that site.
Yeah, that's not absent of a site form. It's that your point is your site form.
Well, yeah, it's all the site data.
Yeah. So, but the point is, if we go to like, rather than like an informational database where, you know, there are types and classes and interpretation and recommendations and stuff like that, and we're actually going to like a raw data database where it's like, here's where all the shovel tests were put, here's where all the artifacts were found, here's where, you know, the types of excavations took place, and you know, there is still missing the interpretation at that point, right? You need an interpretive thing. And while I like the idea of, actually not as a site form, but I like the idea of an interactive dashboard as a report. Mm-hmm. Like it would be a lot more interesting if we could, like, here's a report and it's actually a dashboard, and that, you know, they can click through and kind of walks them through the interpretive process.
For sure.
But there has to be something that provides that interpretation, and that's not algorithmic. I mean, you know, that's, you know, way deeper into like some sort of art of AI interpretation or something like that.
So actually, quick question, Stephen, what do you mean in terms of interpretation? Like what's the level, could you define that a little more? I'm not quite understanding what you mean by that.
Yeah, so like on our site forms, you know, you actually talk about, I mean, most site forms have like, you know, those types that Chris is talking about, like, you don't, you know, maybe we don't have types at all and you just fill that in. These are interpretations of what we've seen, right? Like, is it a farm or a farmstead? Is it, you know, a campsite or a workshop? Or, you know, is it both? Is it a campsite with workshop elements and loci and whatnot? But then most site forms actually have a place for a certain amount of verbiage where you're actually talking about, like, the potential significance on a regional or national scale. Like, I have to talk about what does this site mean? Because that's part of the job. That's part of the, you know, cultural resource management practice. Likewise, I have to provide recommendations. Do we excavate? Do we just avoid? Or are they okay to, you know, blow through it? I'm going to stop there.
Yeah. Well, that's, and you're good. That's good too. And when we come back, we'll dive into that a little more. I'll end just by saying, you know, Nevada has created, after they kind of got rid of the full IMAX form, they created they turned what they had called the short form into their regular form. And it's the closest thing I've seen to what I would call a universal site form, because there are no prompts. There are no checkboxes. There's a site description. There's NRHP recommendations, which, Stephen, to your point, that's where you would put any interpretation you're going to put, because you have to do some analysis and interpretation to give an NHP, NRHP recommendation. So that's kind of where that would go. And the site description is not where that goes. The site description is simply a description of what was found. And it down in the NRHP is where you would say, yeah, I think it's this, which is why we should do this. And this is important because of this, you know, or it's not important, something like that. But anyway, that's, I think they've come closest to actually doing that. And you can find their form on the BLM Nevada website as well, if you want to take a look at that. But let's finish up this discussion on the other side after the break. And we'll be back in a couple minutes.
Are you interested in history
or knitting?
Well, we are too. I'm Heather Boyd.
And I'm Rachel Roden. And we have a new podcast called Historical Yarns that brings the two together.
Each season, we'll have 6 episodes where we dive into the history of a knitting technique and knit a project designed by one of us using that technique.
So join us for season 1 on August 31st, 2018, here on arcpodnet.com/historical yarns. Happy knitting!
This network is listener-supported. We're trying to move away from paid advertising while also creating new shows and supporting the ones we have. The APN has never and will never make a serious profit on our podcast. Every little dime we make goes back into the network and improving show quality. So become a member today at www.arcpodnet.com/members to show your support, get some extras, and be a benefactor for archaeological education. Members get stickers, a coffee mug, a t-shirt, bonus content, early access to episodes, a private Slack team to talk to other members and the hosts, and full access to training on Team Black over at arccert.black. So check out our memberships at www.arcpodnet.com/members today and support archaeological education. That's www.arcpodnet.com/members. Now back to the show. Okay, welcome back to the final segment of the CRM Arc Podcast, episode 141, where we're talking about universal site forms and site forms in general. Doug, you had some comments on the last discussion.
Actually, just a couple of questions. So in a sense of, I guess, do we just need a site form for just basically what you guys are describing as just a brief interpretation and a recommendation? Is that all we need in the site form? And I'll say, like, I've used lots of site forms because that tends to be what gets put into a lot, at least the states I've worked in, the databases. Mm-hmm. So it'll be the information on that form. And that is kind of make or break for a lot of sites because the description will only be something like lithic scatter. Mm-hmm. But then it'll have details like, you know, less than 10, more than 100. More than 1 million lithics or something like that, which can sort of give you an idea of what the site is. And you can look at the GIS and look at the area and stuff like that without having to go and look at every excavation form and stuff like that. So it's a good way to sort of pull together that data. But do you think that's actually needed? I mean, if we're talking about universal site form, are we really just talking about what we think we're seeing and what we should do with it, and that basically should be a 2-box site form?
sort of. That's kind of where I'm at, because I think interpretation and analysis, unless you have to really dive into an NRHP recommendation, the rest of the site form, there's no interpretation, there's no analysis, there's no anything. You're simply just recording information. You're recording what you see. And to me, that's what a site form is. And I think... I was going to mention this, Stephen, when you were talking about site forms earlier, and you know what they're for. As a summary of the site, I personally don't think that's how site forms came about. I think site forms were invented and then developed and came about because people needed prompts for what to record in the field. You know, different people were recording different aspects of what they were seeing, and groups of people came together, usually agencies or something like that, and said, "Listen, we need to all record the same amount of information here. You know, we need to know it at a minimum, this, 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 and this, dot, 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 site form created." And I think that's still what they're for, especially because with CRM archaeology, you know, you always have like one person who's really experienced out there in the field, and maybe not even that, you know, it could be somebody who's been a crew chief for like 3 or 4 years. And then often you've at least got a couple people on the field crew that maybe have never worked in that region before, maybe have never used that site form before, maybe have never, you know, whatever the case may be. And they need prompts. They need prompts for what to record. And that's what the site form does. It says, don't forget about this, don't forget about this, and don't forget about this. It's a to-do list for the site. That's what a site form is. And I think interpretation and analysis, aside from the NRHP recommendation, really should be left to a synthesis of sites, which is called a report. So if you're going to do a report on someplace and you've got the previously recorded sites and their data, and you've got the new sites that you got and their data, then you can come up with this, you know, sort of macro analysis of the region and the valley or the whatever you're recording. That's where the real interpretation comes in. What does this all mean when it all fits together? But analysis of a single site, again, discuss its importance as an entity or as part of the group, you know, if you have to, for the recommendation. But that's really it, you know. So, Stephen.
Yeah, I actually have a couple of things. First is site forms are full of interpretation. Because the things that we hold as data are not necessarily actually data. The way that we categorize, say, debitage or flakes, mm-hmm. or artifacts or any of these things, features, you know, the way that we interpret these, because we're interpreting what we find. It's not actually data. It is processed data. It is a level. It's a low level of interpretation because it's not the entire site, right?
Well, let me comment. Only if you give it a name, and that's why I keep names off my site forms. I don't call projectile points, right? I don't give them a name. I measure them, and I take pictures of them. I let somebody else name those. You know, mining features, those have structured names, things like that. You know, debitage, I always put on my site forms the method I'm using to collect the data. If I call it a primary flake, I better damn well have primary flake defined on the site form, not just in the report. So in that respect, it is just data to me, and it's not analysis or interpretation. It's just simply data.
No, because once you categorize it as a primary, secondary, tertiary flake or hafted biface, or, you know, even if you're not doing types, mm-hmm. right, those are still types. Like a primary flake is a type of flake, and it is one that, you know, like you were saying, you include the definition, but that's still a level of interpretation that's embedded in the site form. And the fact that you're not doing, like, you know, a synthesized aggregate of the smaller, you know, data, it's still interpretive. And to a certain degree, even the way we excavate is interpretive, right? Mm-hmm. Like, sure. You know, it's particularly if you're in a place that does judgmental testing rather than systematic testing. But, mm-hmm. you know, these are all important aspects that go into site forms. And then, you know, I'm going to jump over to my second point now, is where you were talking about, like the purpose of, like, site forms as, like, mnemonic. You know, and I mean, yes, I use forms that way, too. I mean, it's really handy to remember. It's like, oh, crap. Yeah, vegetation. What kind of trees are these? I think that part of that actually is coming from like a settlement model mentality of we're recording certain types of data, including environmental data and stuff like that, you know, site types, whatnot, because we are, it is basically carrying forward the settlement model approach, where we're going to look at how sites are situated on landscape and look at, like, time periods and use and environmental factors and that sort of thing. And then eventually this data will be useful for, you know, saying larger things, which may or may not be the case. There's been more recently, there's been a shift from the idea of, like, sites as things to sites as just management units, which, you know, calls into question its usefulness as like, interpretive model, mm-hmm. or something like that.
Okay. Well, in the last half of this segment, do you guys have any real because you guys have had some pluses and minuses, but overall, do you think that we as a industry should be moving towards some sort of cohesive universal site form, or do you think the current mix of states and agencies, I mean, there's multiple agencies within single states, some of the bigger states that have different forms for how to record stuff because they've decided for one reason or another, this is the form they're going to use. We're fortunate here in Nevada that most of the state is the BLM. And so nearly every agency here just uses the BLM form. I think the Forest Service has occasionally, like, a special form that you use, but most of the time it's just a BLM site form. And so that's good here. But in other states like California, there's mostly the California DPR form, but again, there's a few other agencies that use their own forms. But do you still think that there's a necessity to that from the checklist standpoint, you know, the way I was talking about the site form? Or do you think that we can and should start moving to something universal that allows us to make these more statewide determinations?
To semi-answer that, but to ask actually a couple other questions is, how do you guys end up using site form information? I know, Stephen, you mentioned you'd look up stuff. It'd just be interesting to hear more detail, because I've, again, looking at a state database, looked at, I don't remember how many 100,000 acres, and every single site, and, you know, several, I think it was 1,000 sites or something like that. And basically, mm-hmm. there's the information coming off the site forms that I was able to get access to. So those predetermined checkbox things about number of lithics and pottery and types of features that are present and stuff like that were actually really, really helpful to quickly go through a lot of sites quickly. Mm-hmm. But what was missing actually was a detailed description of those sites. So it's almost the exact opposite of what we were discussing earlier about having almost two boxes, one descriptive entirely. So in that instance, it would have just taken a lot longer having to go through and basically read a description for every single site. So in that case, it wouldn't have helped too much if we'd gone to something, I guess it depends on what that universal is. But how do you guys use it? How do you guys use those sort of forms?
I think it's it really depends on the project. In some cases, there are nearby sites, and I just want a quick reference of, like, what kind of sites are they? You know, like, how deep were they? You know, give me an idea of what I'm looking for, as far as you know, what might be situated within my project area. Other times, it's a lot more settlement model-ish type things, because I used to work, for an agency that had a landmass, right? So it had a lot of different sites, and I was working pretty much with the same data set, mm-hmm. and using site forms, and not the forms themselves, but the same data, because, you know, what we had in the database was essentially those site forms, just in a different format, different layout, same data. That, you know, using that to come up with, you know, a better summary of how things are working across the landscape. And it, like you say, it's not as detailed a description generally as what's in the report. However, you know, when you're dealing with a lot of data, you need to kind of come up with, like, qualitative categories and, you know, ways of manipulating this data to answer your particular questions, which more often than not are, you know, what are these sites like? What are these sites in the area like? And how are they situated on the landscape?
Yeah, I mean, I pretty much use them in the same way. It's when I'm doing background research, you know, what types of things are out there, you know, how big are the sites generally, you know, what kind of things am I looking for? But, you know, the other sort of issue to all of this is the big anomaly that is the isolated find. Because if you're trying to do an analysis of things out there and there is no universal thing across the United States, let's just break it down into this country. There's no universal thing. Like, for example, in Utah, it's 10, I think it's 10 or more artifacts of a single class makes a site. Anything less than that is not a site. It's an isolate. So like 9 flakes is an isolate. And sometimes, and I can't remember if Utah does this or not, but if you have 2 different classes, and it doesn't matter how many artifacts, like if you've got a piece of groundstone and a flake, that's a site. But if you've just got like 9 flakes, that's not a site. That's how it was down at China Lake when we were recording in California. But so, you know, if you don't know that, or, you know, you've got different things going on when you're trying to do these massive interpretations of something, that just changes everything. Because in Nevada, 2 flakes or a flake and a feature, you know, or 2 artifacts or an artifact and a feature makes a site. So it's literally one thing will make it an isolate. And then it depends on how that thing is associated. Like if it's a mining feature and there's You know, there's like a tin can associated with the mining feature. Well, that tin can's associated with the mining feature. That's not an artifact in a feature. That's just a feature with an artifact. So it's still an isolated feature. That's weird. And I wish we could get those. And to me, those definitions of what makes a, what quote makes a site, I don't feel like those decisions are ever made based on cultural information. Those decisions are made based on financial information, financial determination. Like, it's cheaper for an agency to deal with fewer paperwork. If they've got site, you know, billions and billions of sites, and then they say, well, let's change the definition of a site to 10 artifacts rather than 2 artifacts. They just reduce the number of sites they're going to have, you know, by a factor of whatever the hell. So those are economic decisions, not cultural decisions in my estimation. So if we just recorded data and we didn't call it a site, but we just recorded data, going back to what you said, Doug, you know, beyond the universal site form, I think we'd all be way better off. Go ahead, Steven.
Yeah, I'm going to disagree with you on that.
well, that's how it works out here.
Well, it's not... It is kind of a financial decision, but really, there are a number of reasoned resources of why, say, one artifact does not constitute a site, and a lot of it is that it's not that it's not a site. I mean, you know, any artifacts theoretically is a site, right? Like,
right.
A garbage pile from 10 years ago is theoretically a site, yeah, but it's not a significant historic site. And what right. we're worried about, and what most of these agencies are maintaining as far as site databases going, they don't care about the continuous deposition of archaeological material across the landscape. They're worried about places that might be significant.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so most times these cutoff thresholds are actually a cutoff of significance. Like, oh, well, it's only 30 artifacts. You know, there's no way that could be significant. So therefore, you know, like it's like instantaneously evaluated as not, not eligible, or not significant. And so basically is so not significant, it doesn't even make the threshold of being recorded as a site. And depending on where you're at, you might see that with like disturbed areas. Like if something's torn up and you find a few artifacts sitting on the surface, is it still a site?
Mm-hmm.
Some places, yes, but it's a disturbed, you know, it's a destroyed site. Yeah. And other places, like, you know, the attitudes, don't bother recording it.
Yeah.
And so part of that is financial, because you don't want to start the entire evaluation process, which can be costly and involving, like, you know, more contracts and more, you know, public solicitations and you know, stuff like that, if it's just going to be a handful of flakes. You know, if for your area that's not significant, then that's going to be it. You know.
But that's the thing. That's a decision. That's an economic decision made by the agency and not by the people who created the site, right? Like, so you talk to Native Americans out here, and one flake with 500 square miles of nothing around it is significant to them, right? But it's not significant to the BLM. The BLM has decided we don't want to start the paperwork process on one flake. But to any Native American out there, that is something that was put there by one of their ancestors, and it is in fact significant to them, right? And I'm not really getting into all that. This really just is, I'm trying to support my own information and part of what Doug said earlier, in that we should just be collecting data and not really determining whether or not it's, you know, a quote site. Because the problems you run into is, like, for example, you have that one flake in 500 square miles. That's technically doesn't meet the threshold for a site here in Nevada, and it wouldn't meet the threshold for a site in a lot of places. It would be considered an isolate. But the problem with that is the isolate doesn't go down into the searchable data in the same way. You know, I'm not going to find a file cabinet that lists that isolate. You know, it's in a database somewhere, and if I want to see that isolate, I can probably see it, but it's not given the same treatment from a paperwork standpoint that allows me to find it and know that that one flake was there. And maybe that one flake is the tip of the iceberg on something. Maybe it's ridiculous that something should even be there. So what the hell's going on with this story? You know what I mean? I totally agree.
And that's actually a great lead off to my response about whether a universal site form is possible or not.
Yeah.
And my answer is no. And part of that reason, well, I don't even want to say no. I will be nice and say maybe. But the site databases are not intended to be a record of all archaeological material across the landscape. And so if you wanted to do that, you could theoretically do that, starting from whatever we're finding now and just grandfather in. As much data as you can. But databases and the data structuring, like we were talking about in the first segment, is very much, these are designed to answer specific questions, right? And mm-hmm. and we are, you know, using these things, sometimes not in the way that they were originally intended, but you know, that's when, you know, these databases get tweaked and the site forms change and stuff like that, because we're finding different types of data that we can record and we're finding different uses for these databases, you know, apart from the, you know, background settlement model type stuff. So in that sense, you know, is there a possibility for a universal site form? Maybe. And it would really, really matter what the questions are. Like, right. What is the purpose of this thing? Why are we designing it? What are we designing it to do? Like, that needs to be part of the conversation. I think more easily, what you were talking about isn't actually a site form, but it's actually like a universal field data recording form that then gets, you know, like structured in the back end to whatever, you know, regional, you know, like jurisdiction you happen to be, you know, working in. I think that's a hell of a lot more feasible. And I think that that's an inevitable product because, right. You know, unless you work in a very narrow window of places, if you are actually working across the continent and, you know, going from state to state to state, and mm-hmm. you know, where things are not just, you know, like you're not just going to the neighboring state, but you're going to an entire different like ecological region, you know, and cultural right. region. Right. You're gonna want something like that because it's going to like just the amount of back end processing that you would normally have to do to adjust would be, you know, a little expensive.
Okay. Well, on that note, I think we're going to wrap up this discussion. I'm interested to see what our listeners think about this, because I'm sure there are some pretty strong opinions and ideas out there on whether or not this is possible, whether or not we should do it, and your thoughts on how we would do it, or if you don't think we should create a universal site form, we definitely need to fix something about the process across the United States and the way that data are collected in such various different ways and forms. So something's got to happen in my estimation, and maybe it's not a universal site form, but it's something definitely has to happen universally. Anyway, send us your thoughts on that and we'll contact you and maybe discuss it on the podcast or bring you on and have this discussion again, because it's something we could probably talk about quite a bit. So thanks for listening. That's it for another episode of the CRM Archaeology Podcast. Links to some of the items mentioned on the show are in the show notes for this podcast, which can be found at www.arcpodnet.com/CRMArcPodcast. Please comment and share anywhere you see the show. If you'd like us to answer a question in a future episode, email us. Use the contact form on the website or just email chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Support the show and the network at arcpodnet.com/members. Get some swag and extra content while you're there. Send us show suggestions and interview suggestions. We want this to be a resource for field technicians everywhere, and we want to know what you want to know about. Thanks to everyone for joining me this week. Thanks also to the listeners for tuning in, and we'll see you in the field. Goodbye.
Bye. I'm waiting for the seagulls.
He muted. We can't even get seagulls.
Come on, man. Where are my seagulls?
Caw, caw.
Jesus.
Bye, everyone.
This show is produced and recorded by the Archaeology Podcast Network, Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle, in Reno, Nevada, at the Reno Collective.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 US dollars a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to archpodnet.com/members for more info.